the environment. And now your host, Gary Nall.
All right, we seem to be having a little bit of a problem with one of our decks here, so we're going to just reconnoiter and change things up just a little bit, bring you a little bit more of the Skipper Franklin, and then check this tape. This is a taped program, and just make sure everything is all right. So we'll give you a little bit more of Henry the Skipper. And then we'll be back with Natural Living with Gary Nall. All right? Stay tuned. Once again, it's, let's see, 3 past the hour of 12 o'clock. Stay tuned for Natural Living with Gary Nall. That's Still View on the saxophone in the background on the CD, The Hunter, Henry the Skipper Franklin. Moving on to Natural Living with Gary Nall.
Natural Living with Gary Nall, exploring the nature and politics of medicine, health, nutrition, and the environment. And now your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to the program. Today, a continuation of our ongoing forums on trying to resolve the crisis within the Pacifica Foundation and at WBAI, and by extension, hopefully with other stations where there is internal or external conflict. The idea is not to take sides. The idea is to try to hear from everyone, especially those people who either have no longer a forum on the air or those who are being challenged and have no forum whatsoever. We're going to hear from many individuals today, or at least as many as I can get up on the line. And the first person is an individual who I did not know anything of until I received a call from one of my friends. And this is a person who is now offering his insights and financial assistance. He's a successful businessman to unseat the executive board, or at least those people that he is considering the multinationalist and the capitalist takeover people. And also to get the people who were fired at BAI rehired and replace Utrecht Lead. When he came to me, which is shortly after I had returned from a trip, I was out of town during the crucial days that the station changed management, he was very emphatic. He said, Gary, he said, we've got to do something and we need your support immediately. And I said, what is it? And he said, well, it comes down to this. There are 5 major issues. Issue 1, that the Pacifica board has been taken over by a group of really corrupting people. They have no ethic, and they're really doing it so that they can sell off the station. I said, sell off BAI? Yes, sell off BAI and KPFA to start. They'd probably gain about $200 to $300 million. They also have a contract where they can make a 10% commission, hence the incentive. These are people who were not democratically elected, but were self-serving, got themselves on the board. They really don't have any experience or have nothing in common with Lou Hill's original mission in founding Pacifica. These are individuals that you cannot trust. They don't know anything about community radio, and all they want to do is change the format, completely gut out the station of its BetterHelp now, and replace it with people that would make it sound more like a NPR or a Top 40 station to make it more marketable sell. And I said to him, I said, and you have proof of this? He said, absolutely. We have total proof. He said, so I'm expecting you to go on the air and announce that you're going to be supporting us. And I said, well, you certainly should know that I'm not going to jump into anything before I make up my own mind. And then he began something that he had done on a few occasions before. He began to give me a lecture on why that I would be going against the wishes of people by not supporting this, that this was a unanimous choice, that everybody who had any brains or democratic principles were going to throw these thugs out. And I said to him, I said, do you remember when the sexual escapades of the McMartins were going on? They were being challenged by every journalist, every newspaper, every religious group in the country. If we would allow, they would have been strung up. I said, but the trouble was, in the end, they were innocent. And I said, before I would commit myself, I've got to make sure that these charges are correct. And he got really incensed about it. In fact, so incensed that I didn't even speak to him for a while because he refused to speak to me. Instead, he continued to send me harassing letters virtually on a daily basis and admonitions that I was not making the right choice. And I said, I haven't made any choice. I'm just waiting to see what the facts are. So I started to look into the background of just one of these individuals, Andrea Sisco. And she was being picketed at her home, her office. And I simply asked her, would she respond to some facts? And she did. And I asked her for documentation, which she supplied. Then I asked her, how many people have actually come to you and asked you for a sit-down to talk with you? And she said, they haven't. And I was surprised by that. So I'm going to give a form to her and a few other people on both sides of the issue to let you see what you may not have known yet before you make up your mind. Welcome to our program, Andrea Sisco.
Thank you, Gary. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
I don't believe in attacking someone. I believe that you first have to better understand what it is that you're against in order to make sure your own position is supportable. So I'm going to ask you some questions. I'd like you to answer directly to our audience.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Have you now or have you at any time in the past ever been a part of any group or any discussion to sell any of the Pacifica stations, including BAI?
Absolutely not. Not at all. I did not come on the board to sell a station that I have been supporting, that I love as the other listener subscribers do. No way.
So was there ever any plans by any other board members to sell the stations?
I would not say plans. There was an evaluation by one board member.
By Michael Palmer,
actually, who talks about how we might exchange the licenses, I think transfer licenses, something like that. Managers were saying there was not enough money in the till to do the things that they needed. We're always talking about raising the salaries of our people and getting better benefits. national programming, just expanding the scope of all that makes up the network and the stations. And Michael saw that by making some exchanges, it would give us an opportunity to have some more money and, in fact, increase the number of stations or licenses that we might have. However, that never came to the vote. Folks many of us were kind of appalled and thought, no, we're not selling any stations. So it never got past discussion point. It was unfortunate that a memo that he put together got out on a mailing list. That's how I first knew about it, that it got out on this mailing list. I received it in an email, and it wreaked havoc because it has become sort of the mantra of those who are opposed to us, that we are planning to sell the stations. Absolutely not. At no time have I raised my hand to talk about selling a station, nor will I do that. You have my word on that, Gary.
Okay, so that is simply a false allegation with no supporting evidence.
Absolutely.
I spoke with Michael Palmer. Here's what he said in my interview. Quote, in 1966, I suggested, after an in-depth meeting in San Francisco of station managers, program directors, on-air producers, who all gave me their wish list. In fact, they were talking board members for a five-year project. What would we like to see happen to the stations in the next 5 years? They suggested hiring more producers, having more news coverage, have international connections, have better satellite feeds, have more salary and better salary for all people involved at all levels of the station. Everyone thought it was a great idea. The trouble was there was not enough money to pay for all these wish lists. Therefore, I suggested, why not swap a signal? I said, what do you mean by swap a signal? He said, simple. You take a station like BAI and you swap the 99.5 for a number lower on the dial. You sell the existing spot for whatever the market will bear, take that money, and then you have a kitty from which you can do advertising, promotion, good programming, and pay everyone more than a living wage. In effect, it would have helped create a good budget for all the stations, and with the money left over would probably have not required the station to do any on-air fundraising. I thought that it was a reasonable choice. At no time did I ever advocate, nor was it ever in my mind, to drop the stations, never once to exit a market. Instead, it was to strengthen what we had, better facilities, better staff support, better technical support. And unfortunately, my language of being open was used against me. And I would never again be that open, knowing what I know now.
That's right. And it caused Michael to be demonized. I mean, he was offering an alternative plan, even though 99% of the board rejected it. It became something that was used against him, and no one could hear any other recommendations that he made. He was a thoughtful board member, but that issue demonized him. And because he was on the executive committee, I think we all got a part of that. And so it was said that we all colluded, if you will, and wanted to sell the stations. Absolutely untrue.
Well, all right. So there's no evidence. And by the way, anyone in this audience, any advocate for otherwise, who has hard evidence to show that Andrea Sisco or anyone else actively sought to sell the stations, please provide me with that evidence. I would like to see it if it exists. If it does not exist, and if the only thing exists is Michael Palmer naively suggesting that the way that you cause the stations to have the financial stability they require, to have all the facility upgrades they require, to have the income improvements and salaries they require, is to swap a signal, and did so and now it's been used against them, then we should put that in proper perspective if we were to maintain objectivity. Point two. Did you ever meet with Bessie Walsh or anyone else in an effort to take over the WBAI and to replace staff at any time?
Absolutely not. In fact, when what is called the Christmas coup happened, how I found out about it was from a phone call. I had been away out of the country, actually, come home, and I received a phone call. One morning, have you heard what's going on at BAF? I said, no, what are you talking about? And that's how I found out about it. No, we were not, and I'm saying we, I'm speaking for other board members as well, that we were not a part of anything to overthrow BAI. Not at all.
We were also told, in fact, it's been widely disseminated hundreds and hundreds of times, I've gotten at least 900 emails on this, that the reason that there was an effort to sell the station because there was a clause in a contract that would have allowed board member, whoever sold it, to get a commission of 10%. Are you aware of any such document?
I've heard those rumors. I have never seen that document, but it's part of the mythology that has evolved from all of this stuff that is going on. Once the Michael Palmer memo went out, and it started a history of its own, and people just added to it and added to it and added to it, until it's become just like a festering sore, and they keep adding things to it, and that's one of the things. I've never seen a piece of paper. I didn't come to volunteer my time, also to make money from selling a station and stations that I love and that I care about. No way, Gary.
All right, next issue. That you are a capitalist, a wealthy person representing the multinational interest. And by the way, I received two memos from my friend that's what you were. Are you a wealthy person?
No, I'm not. No, I'm not a wealthy person. I'm a working person like everyone else. I'm an independent consultant. Times are up, times are down in the consulting business, and I struggle like a whole lot of other folks. I contribute to BAI, and no, I am not a wealthy person.
Have you ever at any time suggested anything that would have represented a multinational interest?
No, this is absurd. No, absolutely not.
All right. Again,
what does that mean?
Well,
what does that mean?
That means that anyone, from what I understand, that would mean that anyone who had any affiliation or employment with any corporation would be considered, any corporation is considered a large corporation, would be considered serving the interests of the large corporation. Remember, I was told that one of the board members of Pacifica was also on the board of Citibank.
Mm-hmm.
I checked that and found out not to be true, but that was a widely distributed memo, a widely distributed rumor, and my job was not to take any sides, which I have not.
Right.
Instead, just look for facts, and if I find something challenges the assumptions, then that's the way it is.
Right.
Like it or not, people can dislike this information, but if you're making charges against Andrea Sisco, and if you're going protesting in front of her house because she's been demonized, think of the previous witch hunts, think of the Inquisition, think of the McCarthy blacklist. We'd like to think in our own fairy tale mindset that that this kind of activity would never happen by liberals.
Well,
but it is.
But it is happening, and I guess it's part of the shock. The other thing that's the shock for me is that folks who are involved with BAI and with the progressive movement don't listen and don't seek truth. What I was attracted to the station for was what I heard on the air, the questions I heard people asking, the comments that they made, our producers, listeners. And then I hear them going someplace else. They have jumped on the devil's bandwagon, if you will. And they just are accepting all kinds of myths without asking the questions. I mean, I do get some callers, Gary, who I talk to, who listen, who want to know, honestly want to know the truth. Others just call up and say, why don't you resign? My new thing is, why? And what are your three wishes? But some just call up, you're a terrible person. Resign without asking a question. It's a disappointment. This is
next issue against you.
Mm-hmm.
that you were appointed by a group of self-selecting individuals. You did not go through any democratic process to get on the board.
Not true. I came through the lab, the New York lab. I was a member of that lab, and I was nominated to the governing board. That That is how I came. I came to the AI as a volunteer. Samori Marksman took me by the hand to Lois Henry, and they said, we have a survey of listeners, and somebody needs to do the analysis. And I had done surveys in a former life, and I said, well, okay, I'll do it. I'll attempt to do it. It took me 3 or 4 months to do it because I had to hand tabulate the questions that appeared in the folio. I analyzed this survey in as many demographic cuts as I could get. I did.
What happened with it?
Nothing. Nothing happened with it. It had all kinds of good material.
Based on what the audience, the core audience, wanted to hear?
On what the audience wanted to hear, by age, by region, by top issues.
Okay, so you did that as a volunteer.
I did it as a volunteer.
How long did it take you to do that?
It took me a few months. It took me about 3 months because everything had to be hand tabulated and then word processed.
Who'd you give that to?
I gave it to the lab. I gave several copies. I gave to the lab, to Valerie Van Isler. I believe Samori also had a copy. And my disappointment was that it was never used. It was never used.
All right. So let me just summarize here, and you tell me if I'm correct or incorrect. You came up by being a volunteer for BAI.
Yes.
You listened to the station. You liked its progressive message and its freedom of to express itself.
Mm-hmm.
You volunteered. Then you were appointed to the local advisory board of BAI.
Right.
And then that local advisory board nominated you for the national board.
I was actually voted onto the lab.
Okay, so you were voted on. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a democratic process. Now that you're on that national board, you had ideas about how to take the stations forward. Yes? No?
Yes.
All
yes.
right.
Mm-hmm.
And what were those ideas?
The ideas that we had on the board were to have the stations analyze more closely who their communities were and to serve a more diverse audience with more diverse programming. That was the main mandate from the board to the stations. And Frank Milspaugh, who was at that point still a member of the board and chair of the program committee, was given a document by some community people to help with programming so that we could expand our programming, assess what needed to be done. And so we were looking at also enriching the program, not the board. We were working the board with the community, with the station managers, the lab. There was a design which was put together so that we could strengthen the network, if you will. That's what we wanted to do. Strengthen the network, get more listeners, and reach a more diverse audience. That's what we wanted to do. That
okay.
was our aim and our goal.
That's been then reflected in their attack that you wanted to narrow the range to a more populous audience and therefore deprive stations of local and important programming.
That's also not true. That's not true. That's all I can say about it. It is not true. We wanted to expand programming. We wanted to make sure that the community assessment, by the way, it's the lab who is supposed to assess the communities, give the stations that feedback so that they could move forward and really reach the listenership, a more expanded listenership, who is in the community. Who is the community? How many communities do we have to serve? And that's where we were working, hoping to work hand in hand with the labs in the different communities.
How do you reconcile, like in Houston, where it's primarily a music station, or in Washington, where it's primarily a jazz station, to all the other diverse groups that may be served in that community who may not be served now?
What I have heard at the board meetings and speaking to the station managers, that yes, they do have, you know, they do have a heavy music menu, if you will. But they were searching, and I think in Houston, I think their lab did their assessment, and they were looking at ways to increase their audience and to have much more progressive programming. And in fact, it started that. I know that Houston was not having as much news. They increased their news. Garland Gantner was out there trying to have a more progressive menu to offer. In Washington, they were working also to find out what they needed to do. Of course, we had a turnover in station managers there when Bessie became executive director. And so I'm not sure exactly what has happened in Washington. One of the other things that we talked about is music, you know, is also progressive and political. And if that is what the community asked for, that's what the community should get. But I know they were looking at more talk programs and more issue-oriented shows. And I can't say what the status of that is right now.
Okay, so if I could summarize your position, you have never been a part of any effort to sell the stations. You're not aware of any effort to sell the stations outside of Michael Palmer's suggestion, which he believed would have helped overall, and that was turned against him. You have not had or seen or made any effort to profit from this, and that you were not a part of any effort to take over BAI. Weren't even aware of it until there was, you heard about it, and that you are there to serve the community, but the community has members, some members of the community have been attacking you without ever speaking with you. Is that true or not?
That's true. That's true. And I am still here to serve, despite that.
All right. Okay. One last comment. What do you see as a way to help in healing? We've talked about the problem, because up till this point, I want the audience to realize, Andrea Sisco has not gone public once. And I find that unfortunate that there are journalists attacking her who have never interviewed her. I would like to know what the standards of responsibility for journalists is to attack someone, condemn them, vilify them, without ever interviewing them. I find that unfortunate, to say the least. So this is her first opportunity after all this harassment, people contacting her her clients to try to dissuade them from doing business with her and threatening them if they do. If her clients continue to do business with her, they'll pick at their businesses and harass them. And that is not something I would advocate unless you've got real good evidence that a person has done something so egregious that political action of this type is deemed necessary. And I'm just afraid that too many people have been running here and there on false assumptions. They have not done their homework. Many of their leaders have not done their homework. And when leaders have not spoken with people they're attacking, then I have to ask, how responsible is that leadership? Have you been been spoken with by any of the people who are attacking you?
I've been spoken to by Bernard White. Bernard has requested that I sit down and meet with a number of individuals. However, last week on your show, you talked to Ken Ford and made the proposition that Bernard White come and speak with board members, and I think that's really a good thing, that he sits and talks to the 12 remaining board members. Folks should know he could have done that at the time he had a problem. Valerie did make a request to the board to have the decision to terminate her, to have that overthrown. She did make an appeal. Bernard also could have made an appeal. But it's not too late to have that conversation, or at least to have a conversation. Can't talk about personnel matters, but Bernard has called, and there have been a couple of others. Karen Frillman, who is the former lab chairperson, has called on a number of times, and we've had conversations. So I think Karen, I would not say, is the opposition. I think Bernard is, and I do understand that. But there have been some. But there have been so many others who just call and demonize me and tell me I must resign and send me emails and call my house at any time in the morning, in the night, late in the night, fax me all night long. It's kind of unpleasant. Kind of unpleasant what they do. And they don't want to hear reason.
Well, this is a forum to start the process of healing, and we cannot heal what we're not aware of. And since you have been attacked, mercilessly attacked, nonstop, I wanted to provide you with a forum to share your side. You've made your points. It is not for me to challenge whether those points are honest or not. If anyone has any information, hard information, not hearsay, not innuendo, I work on facts. Then please present that and understand if anyone has given me facts that refute anything that Andrea Sisco says, I will present those to our audience. If no one has those hard facts, and I don't care about your opinion is worthless to me, your facts are meaningful, then present those facts. Otherwise, then it's very possible that they have been attacking the wrong person. You are allowed in our society. In fact, BAI and Pacific encourages challenge. We can share differences of opinion with people without attacking them. And I believe that it says something when the only way we feel we can communicate is from a point of desperation where we lash out at someone. And I have not heard Andrea Sisco say anything negative about anyone, nor lash out nor attack. And I'd like reason to be brought to this discussion, not just animosity. Thank you very much for being on.
And I thank you.
I'm Gary Nall. Let's see who next we have on the phone. We'll go over and say hello to our next panelist. And now we'll go over to our next guest. This is a person who has virtually been invisible for most of this debate. You haven't seen her quoted. You haven't heard her on the air. And yet, she has a great deal of insight and information to share. Her name is Sybil Wong. Sybil Wong was an important element at WBAI and in the Pacifica issues for a number of years. She has been trying to address the problems both locally and nationally to the degree that she has given input. But she has, up to this point, not had a forum, and we're happy to provide her with that forum today. Nice to have you with us today, Ms. Wong.
Thank you, Gary.
First, let's talk about how you see the problem evolving, and then we'll go into the solutions. And I know you have a lot to share on that. Let me give you some of the ideas of what many of us were told. I was specifically told this by two people who are supposed to be credible, and they told me that I was out of town when all this occurred at BAI, and I was told that there had been a conspiracy to take over WBAI. I was even told, in fact, I was given several letters that my show, the show that I host, was one of the targets of that takeover because the moldy nationalist, let me quote verbatim, here's what I was told: Gary, you're the target. They intend to take you off. Do you think for a second, I'd ask a question in return, why me? Do you think for a second that these moldy nationalists are going to allow someone who has done so much to challenge their illegal activities? And I said, who specifically are you referring to? They said, well, the transnationalists. And I said, can you be specific? Can you give me any names? And they said, well, one of the board members is on the board of directors of Citibank. I said, which one? I don't know the board members. I haven't been in communication with them. And couldn't give me a specific name. He said, get back with me on the name. So initially, I was led to believe that I was the target, one of the targets, that they were going to take off any shows that would have challenged their position on, from the Cancer Society to medical doctors, pharmaceutical industries, you name it. I go after these people. So I thought, all right, that is plausible, but is it a reality? Then I was told that Utrice Lead had been working for a long time as a part of the conspiracy and to take over BAI. Gut it, eviscerate it, and the only programs that would be left on there would be programs that would be non-threatening programs, music programs and some local programs. But they would then move in to put their kind of more commercial programs on the air, appealing to a larger audience, so they could put the station up for sale. That this was being run by a small group of approximately 6 to 7 people who were all directly affiliated and with multinational corporate interest, that once those people had gotten the station up for sale, that there was a 10% commission that they would get. And he was saying that, well, you realize BAI could sell for anywhere from $160 to $250 million. So he said, Gary, look at the amount of money they're making. Again, I asked questions, but I'm not in the city. I had no facts. I had no one I could speak with. I had no names or phone numbers, and I simply was listening to this one person give me this. But mind you, this one person has been one of the primary people at all the meetings, demonstrations, personally funding. He's a wealthy person, personally funding a lot of the lawsuits. And he said that I must get on the air and attack. And I said, A, I'm not even where I could get on the air. I don't have a satellite link up, but I can't get on the air. All my shows are on tape until I get back. But I said, you realize that I'm not going to automatically do something you suggest I do. And he got very angry with me, which is his nature. If you disagree with him, then suddenly you go from being a friend to an enemy. And he made some statements to me that I really found abhorrent, that I should trust him without doing my own homework. And yet I pride myself on all the investigations I do of trying to stay as neutral as possible and just look at facts. I said, but I would look at all the facts. I then called Valerie Van Isler and asked her for her position, what was going on, and she led me believe that it was all a surprise to her. She had no knowledge that this was going to happen, that it was all just instantaneous. It was like a coup, and that they were going to be firing everyone. And I said, well, I'll do what I can. And then I tried to call Bessie Walsh, but without success. And then I came back. Then I really took my time to start doing the investigation. That's what I was told. So there was a conspiracy. Utrice was a part of it, meeting to make the stations, put them in play, take it over so that the whole network, Pacifica Network, became, in effect, a, quote, a capitalist tool. That is the initial information I was given. From your perspective, would you go through what you know, having worked at the station, been a business manager at the station, and tell us what is fact and what is fiction?
Well, it's somehow difficult for people to jump into this struggle in the middle of it. And there are truth and there are half-truth facts and semi-facts on both sides of the struggle. So I will try to get back as far back as I can, see if we can, you know, sort this out a little bit, you know, more clearer. I will separate the struggle in two factions, two parts. One is local struggle within WBAI, and the other is struggle against a national, Pacifica National Board and the policy and the direction they're taking WBAI and other stations. Now here at WBAI, the closest I can recall was in July of 1994, when we received a directive from the national, particularly the executive director then, Pat Scott, a clause which said must carry clause. That means that if three stations out of the five Pacifica stations want a program to go national, then all the five stations must carry that particular program. The alarm sounded here at WBAI, particularly Sir Murray Marksman. At that time, he was the program director. It was discussed immediately in July 1994 at a staff meeting here at WBAI to say that if Pacifica National has already controlled three stations of the five, namely W in Washington, K in Houston, and K in Los Angeles, then what chances does WBAI and KPFA have in terms of deciding what should go national? National programming means that the local station have to remove local programming in order to accommodate national programming. So we said that we must fight this. That means that if you don't fight it, then the national can come in to remove any of the local programming, then put in national programming dictated by three stations. In our perception at that time, they have already controlled those three stations. So immediately, the producers called a meeting in September of 1995. At that meeting, there's the most producers ever I've seen. About 44 producers met at this meeting. They formed a group called Producers Alliance. At that time, the producers said that we've got to be very vigilant because we don't want them to put in national programming because that means strip programming That means a certain hour every day, a local program must be preempted or taken away to accommodate national programming. Now, at their producers' meeting, my feeling was that some of them were genuinely fighting for truly local autonomy in deciding programming. The other producers are really trying to save their airtime. But anyway, for whatever motive they have, the consensus was that we must fight this must-carry clause. And eventually, evidently, the struggle was so strong, the national decided to stay away from this must-carry clause for a while. But since no national programming was really forthcoming, and therefore the Producers Alliance kind of fizzled off. And in its place, there's a group called SOS, Save Our Stations. In the beginning, they were half producers and half listeners from this SOS, Save Our Stations. For the same reason, they do not want the national to come in to dictate programming on local stations here at WBAI. So SOS was formed in 1996, Save Our Stations. And in the meanwhile, KPFA was in trouble. As you recall, the general manager was removed, and there was a chaos and closing down of the station KPFA. And the listeners and the producers from the group now brought it over now to the others who go into the national struggle. The KPFA producers and listeners form a group called Take Back KPFA. And in the meanwhile, the KPFA people and WBAI people and some in KPFK and one or two in KPFT in Houston decided to form an email address group so that we can communicate with each other in case there's any struggle to require a national alliance among the five stations. Unfortunately, W in Washington was not that active and did not join us in this struggle. Now, in the meanwhile, WBI, things seem to be quiet down a little bit because, you know, there's not really any national programming taking over, except Samori Marksman, at that time as a program director, was under tremendous pressure to take a national programming. So he decided to try on Jerry Brown's program, as you recall, you know. And it did have it for a while at WBAI until Jerry ran for mayor out in California and won, and that program was no longer offered. But however, now we'll bring it back to 1997 at the National Board meeting. They decided to change the governance, change the bylaw at the national level. As you recall, the National Board used to consist of two representatives from the local advisory board members from five stations, each two each, that mean 10, plus about 5 to 7 at large. In this way, at least, we feel that the local stations are being represented by its members and local advisory boards. But in 1997, they have decided at a national level that even those two representatives from each local advisory board will be eliminated. And there's a tremendous uproar from every one of the local stations, because even before they changed the bylaw, there were hardly any influence from the local advisory board to the national board. As you recall, I was a business manager at WBI for about 5 years, since 1994. But at the same time, I was also a board member, a local advisory board member, elected by the paid staff to represent them to sit on the local advisory board. So in addition, I was also a shop steward, elected by my shop here at WBAI, and also I was a union officer, a UE Local 404. So I've been very active in trying to keep track of what is really going on, because at the same time, at that time, Pat Scott was executive director at WBAI, and they are trying to remove all the unpaid staff at KPFA, KPFK, and WBAI who used to be members of the respective unions. They were able successful to remove all the unpaid staff at KPFK and KPFA And we know that they are trying to remove the unpaid staff members of UE Local 404 and WBAI. Now, why would they want to remove the union, the unpaid members of the union at the various stations? And what's very clear to us at that time is that if they want to remove any local programming, that means they have to remove the producers of those programs. And they realize it's more difficult to remove union members, producers, than non-union members, producers. And therefore, they took us to NLRB, and we won a battle here at WBI, a local NLRB. They said, the local people said, the unpaid staff, even though they are not paid, however, they perform the same functions as the paid staff union members of WBI. Therefore, under certain clause, they are qualified union members. But unfortunately, the NLRB, the national headquarters in Washington, reversed that decision. Now, you understand, Gary, at that time, the struggle really intensified because we fear that once the unpaid producers are removed from the union bargaining unit protection, that means the national can come in to remove any one of those producers and take away their programming. And there is actually, there's a fear, those are facts, but they haven't done it. They haven't done it, I think, at that time, because the struggle at KPFA was so strong that so many listeners supported KPFA, so they didn't dare to come to WBI. They mean certain people at the national level don't dare to really come in to really mess with WBI. So at the moment, at that time, in 96, 97, 98, 99, was almost like a standstill. You know, both parties, both groups are taking their positions. However, things have changed a little bit. There was a summer of 1999, as I understand it. Raven Isler, at that time, was our general manager at WBI, was more or less notified by the new executive director, Bessie Walsh, that her contract will not be renewed for that December, the end of that year. Am I wrong? The date, maybe 2000, I'm sorry. Yes, the end of that year, the contract will not be renewed. Now, you understand that our general manager at that time, Raven Isler, was not a popular general manager at WBAI. In fact, she lacks managerial skill, and she really doesn't understand the finances, the budgeting at WBAI. And the WBAI producers, the majority of them, including the WBAI Local Advisory Board, have been trying to get rid of the general manager in Isla for about 5 years. I remember my first LAB meeting in 1994. Discussion was already in hand about removing Varip and Isla. The main reason the national board has not removed Varip and Isla because she was playing a role that they wanted her to play, which is to get rid of the unpaid staff union members at WBAI. That means you're asking her to bust the union for them, for Pacifica. Now, we have appealed to the national board. In fact, we have confronted the national board at every national board meeting here at New York or in Washington, D.C. We used to bus our people down there to talk to the national board, to appeal to them that they should not bust the union, trying to explain to them why the unpaid staff need to remain in the union. But unfortunately, at that time, the national board was not really paying attention to us, particularly after Mary Frances Berry took over as the chair of the national board. Somehow, this confrontation existed as far back as I remember in 1995 between the national board and its executive director, Pat Scott, to the local station, particularly WBAI and KPFA. There's never been a time where we could sit down together and talk about all these issues. That's why I'm so glad, Gary, now you're trying to do it. But the antagonism has existed for so long, to the point that the WBAI and its board members and KPFA, you know, the staff, the listeners, the local advisory board have absolutely no faith in the national board because, take for example, finances. We could never really get any clear financial statements from them. We asked through the local advisory board, HWBAI, asking for financial statements, and it's always rebuffed. We were never able to get anything. Of course, the annual budget, which they have a file, you know, with the Internal Revenue Service, is available. But however, it doesn't give a line-by-line breakdown of each station's budget. And that's what we want. We want to find out where the money goes to, where the money comes in from, and who decides to spend it, where they will spend it. But somehow we never seem to have that kind of information. I remember at the national meeting down in Washington, I stood up and I talked about finances. At that time, Mary Frances Berry seemed to be interested and let me have about more than the normally limited 2 minutes for, you know, public public session. But however, after that national board meeting, again, nothing was forthcoming. So there has been established this kind of, as I said again, antagonism to the national. Since they tried to change the change of bylaw in February 1999, and it is absolutely at that time the battle line seems to have been drawn, you know, because that bylaw amendment change is actually taking away so-called power from each local advisory board, that means from each station. However, I do have criticism of the local advisory board at WBAI. Now, I don't know what the advisory board was elected or selected from the other station. At WBAI, the fault actually falls on the listeners and on the board members and the staff here at WBAI. Because the local advisory board theoretically represent the listeners, really the listeners, because the staff are represented by two members of the local advisory board, one elected by the paid staff, one elected by the unpaid staff. At that time, Mimi Rosenberg was the unpaid staff representative to the local advisory board, and I was the paid staff representative to the local advisory board. So at every board meeting, Mimi will represent the interests of the unpaid staff, and I will represent the interests of the paid staff. However, my criticism of the local advisory board members, in fact, I told them as much vocally in front of them. I said, how could they possibly advise us? They hardly know what's going on at the stations. They don't come to the station that often. And I don't know about their constituencies. We urge them to have town hall meetings with the listeners so that they have input from the listeners and therefore input into LAB meetings and therefore up to the national level. And that, as far as I can see, I left WBI under protest in 1998, so I don't see any really so-called big meetings, town hall meetings, local advisory board have held to the listeners so that they have some input into the policy making.
Okay, let's just put a halt there for a second so I can recapitulate this,
yeah.
All right? If I understand you correctly, that for a number of years, there has been a basic antagonism between the National Board, who, from my interviews with the members of the National Board, past and present, is that many of the local stations were in the red. They did not serve the all the different various factions of the audience, and they believed that there should be more input on the quality of the programmings, and hence they tried to produce national programming, by the way, which Democracy Now! And others are a part of that, that would go into these stations. The local stations frequently resented this, knowing Samori Marksman, actually being with him on some planning sessions where he was trying to get local programming from BAI to be syndicated to other stations. It was also fought. So as if there were little stations trying to be completely autonomous. They didn't want to take programming, and yet when they had good programming, wanted to offer it out, it was frequently rejected. So there was a difference in egos, a difference in ideological feelings about where Pacifica should be, and therefore the people who had the power, which were at the national board, were not open to the type of communication that would have helped resolve these issues and to have provided forms for the best programming from all stations, KPFA, KPAI, to take whatever shows would have really been good on any other station and help to syndicate those shows within its own network and outside. It was like a territorial. This is our show. I know because I was a part of that. My show was rejected constantly, even though Andrew Phillips and Samori Marksman did their best to try to syndicate it. It was rejected every single place it went, and no one at the national board helped, and even the individual stations fought it, and then they would try to get their shows syndicated. It was, in effect, I saw it, standing back from it all, I saw it as a bunch of people simply not wanting to communicate or cooperate, not only the national board with the local stations, even the local stations frequently with the local stations. The local community board, in your opinion, did not really always communicate or represent what the issues were clearly to the audience. So the audience didn't have a heads up on all the things happening, so they could have been more active in their participation on issues they found important. The union busting, you're claiming that Valerie Van Isser was really kept in position against all of the people at the stations, from volunteers and department heads and program directors, who wanted her out. There was an active campaign to remove Valerie Van Isser by her own staff for years, but they kept her in there because she was a union buster and therefore protected their interest. And then finally, with the coming in of the new executive director, Bessie Wallace, she said, Valerie, in June, she said, your contract's not going to be renewed. We're getting another program director, or another station manager, but we're not going to just replace you. We're going to give you another job, actually a $7,000 increase, and you'll be executive producer, and you'll be able to produce your own programs, and we're going to get someone from the station. And that, up to that point. Now, is that fairly accurate, inaccurate?
That's very accurate, but I would not just say that they're using Barry as the union busting here, WBEI. That was one of the reasons why they insisted her to remain at WBEI as general manager. Even though at some open staff meeting, when Lynn Chadwick became the executive director after Pat Scott. Now, Pat Scott was the executive director, then Lynn Chadwick, and now Bessie Walsh in that sequel. A few times when Lynn Chadwick came to WBR to talk to the staff in front of Ari, and many of the staff were quite vocal, begging, actually, Lynn Chadwick at that time to remove Valerie. Now, to me, that is really a side problem that we have. But I think that one of the biggest problems that I see is controlling of programming. Now, who has the power to control programming at the national level and at the local level? The main reason there are not that many programs, including yours, Gary Noll, to go national is because it costs money to produce a national programming. Take Democracy Now. Before Democracy Now, there's only one national programming at Pacifica, which is the Pacifica National News. Backtrack a little bit. Who pays for this national programming? It's out of the 17% levy on every station. You know, people scream and say, why should every station pay to the national the 17%? We scream too here at WBEI, but I'm beginning to understand. Some of the money has to go to the national to produce national programming and produce, to keep certain national staff particularly. All the payroll checks are issued from the national, not locally. And therefore, they have to keep a controller and certain people working in the controller's office at WB at Pacifica. Some of the money they spend, which we need to criticize, which is on security guards, on slick public relations, and on lawyer fees. That's another matter, you know, deciding for Pacifica National to decide how money should be spent. Come back to national programming. There was only one national programming before Democracy Now, which is Pacifica National News, pay out of the 17% levy, including Democracy Now. You know, Democracy Now started, I don't remember the date now, I think in 1996, 97, when the National decided to do a program on 100 days of Congress, you know, when the Congress changed, remember? You can fill up the date later. It was supposed to be only cover 100 days of Congress. And after that, that national program is supposed to be dissipated. I mean, only 100 days, right? And but after that program was successful, it was co-hosted at that time by Amy Goodman and Larry Bensky. Of course, there was tremendous struggle between the East Coast and the West Coast, who should co-host or who should host this so-called Democracy Now! Program. The West Coast naturally wanted Larry Bensky, but the East Coast, particularly Samari Marksman, wanted Amy Goodman. So a compromise was made. So they made both Amy Goodman and Larry Bensky as co-hosts of this 100 days of the Congress.
Ms. Wong, we're running out of time here. You've given us a lot of good insight. I do have two questions, if you could answer mm-hmm. them rather succinctly.
Mm-hmm.
To your knowledge, was there any effort on the behalf of Utrice Lead and Bessie Walsh or anyone else to conspire to take over the station?
Well, I would not say conspiracy. I would say that after Varian Isler was informed that her contract was not going to be renewed, somehow, unfortunately,